This podcast is brought to you by Business Radio, powered by Wharton.
From the campus of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School, this is the Real Estate Hour on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. Here's your host, Bob Lane.
Thank you, listeners. Welcome to the Real Estate Hour here on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School on SiriusXM Channel 111. I'm your host, Bob Lane. I'm an adjunct professor teaching real estate law and transactions here at the Wharton School. And my day job is I'm a practicing commercial real estate lawyer as a partner at the law firm of Stevens & Lee. We're now live at noon Eastern every Friday, followed by Behind the Markets at 1 p.m. Eastern. As always, you can access past shows via our on-demand feature. If you're listening between 12 noon and 1 p.m. Eastern on Friday, April 21, we're live here in the studio, so please feel free to call and you'll get us in person and we'll be happy to address your questions at 1-844-WHARTON. That's 1-844-942-7866. If you're listening in another day or time, and we hope you will be listening to our rebroadcast, please feel free to email your questions and comments and I'll be happy to address them on my next show or by email. So if you have a question during today's discussion on Friday, April 21, please give us a call at 844-WHARTON. That's 1-844-942-7866. And you can email your questions to businessradio@siriusxm.com. And of course, you can follow us on Twitter at bizradio111.
I can't follow people on Twitter either.
Whoever said that. Anyway, my guest today is David Gorenberg. David is the former head of the Citibank's National 1031 Exchange Service and is presently the executive vice president and counsel of Riverside 1031, a terrific 1031 exchange company about which David will tell you more in a few minutes. And you'll hear that 1031s are like-kind exchanges of real estate and other assets under the Internal Revenue Code, and we're going to be talking about that principally today. However, if you're want to call us at any time based on our theme of like-kind exchanges, feel free, or any real estate question, and we'll be happy to address them during our hour. Again, at 1-844-WHARTON. That's 1-844-942-7866. So let me officially welcome my guest, my frequent and repeated guest, David Gorenberg. David, welcome.
It's good to be back.
You're always a delight. And you'd think that 1031 exchanges are like an arcane kind of niche area, but it's amazing how many listeners are fascinated by the idea of just saving tremendous amount of taxes and building their wealth. And we're going to talk a lot about that in a few moments. But first, why don't we start out with getting some of your background, because you've had an interesting road to what you're doing now.
Sure. So I started my professional career as a practicing attorney in South Jersey. I focused primarily on business and real estate transactions. In fact, my first 1031 exchange, I was representing a seller and then buyer who was doing a 1031 exchange. And I then learned that you can actually make a full career out of 1031 exchanges. So I've now been doing 1031 exchanges as a qualified intermediary.
And we'll discuss what that means
correct.
In a little while.
Yeah. So I've now been doing this full-time for almost 20 years. Recently, I was the head of Citibank's 1031 service, as you alluded to. We built that from the ground up, and then for internal reasons, Citi decided no longer to do that. I was also the president of the Federation of Exchange Accommodators, the 1031 Exchange Trade Association, a wonderful organization. And I'm now, as you said, the executive vice president and counsel at Riverside 1031, a boutique 1031 exchange company located in New York and New Jersey. We handle transactions all around the country.
Now, some of our listeners who may be really familiar with this whole area of real estate and tax law, as well as other assets, maybe thinking, well, I've heard a lot about 1031 exchanges maybe being eliminated in the Internal Revenue Code. And I want you to know that we're going to address that very specifically and write it with up-to-the-minute information toward the end of our hour. But I think many of our listeners probably don't know much about what 1031s are. So maybe we could start off with what's the basics? How does it work?
So in a nutshell, if I meet somebody and they ask me what it is that I do, I explain 1031 exchanges as playing Monopoly with real property and real money.
My favorite game.
Yeah. We play Monopoly with real property and real money. And we structure the transaction such that we do not pay capital gains tax when we sell Pennsylvania Avenue to upgrade to buy Boardwalk.
No way.
Absolutely, 100%.
Okay. So how does that work?
So how it works is if you were to sell Pennsylvania Avenue outright, in our current tax system, you would have to pay capital gains tax and depreciation recapture tax to the extent that you've taken depreciation. However, if you follow the rules of Section 1031, you can defer those taxes. And what happens is, prior to the sale of Pennsylvania Avenue, you engage the services of a qualified intermediary who will prepare some additional documentation, including an exchange agreement and an assignment. And now what has happened is you have assigned your rights in the sale of Pennsylvania Avenue to the intermediary. So the intermediary now receives the cash proceeds on your behalf and holds them in escrow on your behalf during the time of the exchange. Now you have a period of time within which to identify and then acquire Boardwalk.
So what most people would have thought, and I think is the way 1031 exchanges started almost 100 years ago, right?
Right.
Is that you really have to swap your real estate. It's a like-kind exchange. So I have Boardwalk, you have Park Place, or we want to get those together, right? So I have Pennsylvania Avenue for those who know Monopoly, but whatever. So I have a property, and you have a property I want, and I no longer want mine. We have to sit down and exchange deeds so that there's no money transpiring, and that's why you wouldn't pay that's why you wouldn't pay taxes. Isn't that how it started?
Well, in 1921, yeah, that was the original premise of the transaction. You have a farm on the Pennsylvania side of the Delaware. I have a farm on the New Jersey side of the Delaware, and we swap our farms. That was the initial premise of the transaction.
And that way, then, there was no money, and so the federal government Internal Revenue Service said, all right, look, you know, if a river changes course, and so now you've got some of my farming land and I've got some of yours and we want to swap, that shouldn't be taxed. So
correct.
If it's really like-kind in that way, you can exchange it and not pay taxes.
Correct.
So now, and you were explaining the way it works now it's totally different.
Well, over the years, between cases going to court and Congress changing statutes, it has evolved to include not just real estate. Now, clearly, we're here to talk about real estate today, but it includes virtually any business or real estate asset.
So business or – so anything held for investment.
Business or investment
trade,
asset, yes.
Right. So your personal residence you can't
correct
do this with.
Nor can you do it with your beach house or your Pocono ski chalet, whatever.
Right. So it's got to be either part of your business property or something you have for investment.
Correct.
Is there any holding period? If I buy something for my business today, can I swap it in a month from now or exchange it?
Well, theoretically, yes. But if you buy it specifically with the intent to resell it, it has become inventory, and inventory is not permitted to be used as 1031 exchange.
But what if I'm not in the business of doing real estate? So it's not, I bought it today. It's not really something I decided. I got something better, but so it's like 9 months later, I want to exchange it for something different.
Well, the scenario I talk about frequently is you buy a piece of property, and then maybe you get an unsolicited offer. Somebody wants to buy it from you. Nobody will tell you can't do a 1031 exchange there because your intent was to use it as an investment property.
Right. So if you're a big home builder or office buildings and if that's your stock and trade, you can't buy and sell your quote inventory if that's
correct.
Your business. It's got to be. You could be in the plastics business and you have your factory building and you've grown out of that building. You want another one. So rather than selling, paying taxes on the capital gains on your old building and buying a new one, you can do this exchange.
Correct.
Okay. So there's no deadline per se in how long you have to hold the property as long as it doesn't look like you're
as long as trading. You held it for a qualified use. Correct.
A qualified use. Great. So now, this delayed exchange, which is how you really do it. So, you know, like in sports, you and I have been talking about, you have a three-way trade of players because, one team wants my player. I don't want anybody on their team, but I want another team. And so you have like a three-way trade. You don't have to all come down to the same table because somebody you may want my property, but you may not have the property I want. Somebody else does. So, in effect, what you've explained, and we'll dive a little deeper into that. You and I go to a closing. I can't touch the money. right? If the money comes to me, I got to pay taxes on it.
Correct.
So I can't like hold it, put it in an account.
If it goes to your attorney, you pay taxes on it. You can't even have constructive receipt of those funds.
Nor your accountant, nor your uncle,
and a variety of other folks. Correct.
So it's got to be somebody who's remote from me, and that's why people like you come in. You're
correct.
A qualified intermediary, somebody who's got no relationship. So you couldn't, even if it's your business, you couldn't do this for your brother-in-law.
In fact, when the owners of our company wanted to do a 1031 exchange recently, I had to refer them to a colleague in another company because their company that they own, cannot be their intermediary.
Ah. Okay. So before I actually shift gears, because I just realized we've been on for a longer, this went by 10 minutes very quickly. Let me just welcome our listeners who are tuning in late. Listeners, you're welcome to the Real Estate Hour. Thank you for joining us. You're listening to Sirius XM 111, the Real Estate Hour. I'm your host, Bob Lane, and I am an adjunct professor teaching real estate law and transactions here at the Wharton School by night. And my day job is I've been a practicing commercial real estate lawyer for almost 40 years, if you can believe it, David. I'm that old. We're talking to David Gorenberg, who is one of the foremost authorities in the United States, former head of Citibank's 1031 program, and now the senior vice president and counsel for Riverside 1031. And we're talking about how to take advantage of this terrific tax, structure and mechanism to avoid paying taxes on real estate if you're moving up in real estate, exchanging it, buying new real estate. And we're going to talk about how actually you end up never paying taxes because it's generally
correct.
A deferred program so that you defer it until you ultimately sell your last property. But there is a loophole where you never pay taxes, and we're going to get to that later on. We're also going to talk about tax reform and what's going to happen with 1031 probably in the second part of our hour. So, again, welcome new listeners, and thanks for staying with us, those who started with us. So we've been talking about how 1031 exchanges, David explained, started out almost 100 years ago as you really had to swap my real estate for your real estate, one farmer or another, whatever. Or other assets, held for investment. And then we've sort of explaining how the deferral works so that if you don't have the property I want, I can sell it, give it to the qualified intermediary, which is what you do for a living, the money. And then how what are the rules? How does that work?
So let's assume for a moment, Bob, that you've sold your investment real estate and today was the closing. So at the closing table, the cash proceeds will come to me, the intermediary, to hold on your behalf. You will then have 45 days from today within which to identify a potential list of replacement properties. And the statute says that list must be delivered to me on or before midnight or on or before the end of the 45th day after the closing. So today is the day you sold the property. Today is day zero. And then you have a total of 180 days from today, so two stopwatches starting at the same time, a total of 180 days from today, or the due date of your tax return, whichever comes first.
Ah, and that's something that some people can make a very serious mistake on,
correct.
Just assuming that they have that 180
correct.
Days. So what would be an example of that people would be mindful of?
So, for example, if you sold your investment property, assuming we're calendar year taxpayer, if you went to closing on the sale of your investment property on the Monday after Thanksgiving, right, we're now at the end of November, you'd think, wow, I have until the end of May to complete my 180-day acquisition. But your tax return was due April 15th, or this year April 18th, which puts you six weeks late.
Right. So if you waited till the beginning of May, you're
right. And the purpose, the reason there is that the 1031 exchange transaction needs to be reported on that year's tax return. So you need to either complete the exchange
or,
so you can report it,
yeah.
or you have to pay the tax.
Well, isn't there something else you can do?
Well, you can file for an extension.
Right.
Right.
So
which
is
relatively simple, but you still have to file.
So if you're mindful and you keep your eye on the calendar and you put all this out there and you're careful, even if you did close in November, December of a particular year and you want to push beyond April 15th of the following year, just file that extension.
Correct. But you still never get more than 180 days
never
to complete
more.
Your exchange.
Right, right. By the way, listeners, I just want to, if you want to join our conversation, if you have a 1031 exchange question or experience or something you want to share, or any real estate question, please call us at 1-844-WHARTON. That's 1-844-942-7866. And if you call on to Friday, April 21st, we're live in the studio and we'll take your calls directly. If you're listening at another time, please email us at I dropped my notes. businessradio@siriusxm.com, and I'll be happy to address your questions at another time. So, David, how many properties can you identify? So you have to identify a list in 45 days and then close on one of those, not another property.
Correct.
Within the 180 days. And the 180 days starts from day one, not from day 45.
Correct.
So the 45 is the first 45 days of that 180 days. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay, so I want to buy a property in Philadelphia with my exchange money. So I just give to you, the qualified intermediary, the Philadelphia phone book, and say I'm going to buy one of these properties. Huh?
Wonderful idea. Unfortunately, Congress and the IRS are onto that game, and they say, no, you can't do that.
So
they've come up with a three-prong approach, and actually there's a fourth prong. You can actually, if you know what you're going to buy and you close on that, on the acquisition, within the 45 days. So you sold property number one, you bought property number two, and your 1031 exchange is complete within the 45 days. It is automatically identified. You don't have to also go back and identify. But let's assume you're going to take longer. So on or before the end of the 45th day, there are three rules. Rule number one says you can identify up to three properties, no questions asked. And the truth of the matter is the vast majority of our clients identify one or two or three properties, and they say, David, I'm going to buy one of the following three properties. Piece of cake. Easy. But if they're using the Section 1031 exchange, maybe they want to diversify their holdings and spread their real estate out over multiple counties, or they're seeking to break apart larger holdings, maybe as part of an estate plan so that six grandchildren will inherit.
Well, we're going to get to that example a little bit later, but that's some really terrific ideas.
Absolutely.
How you've taught me over time of how we can use this. So let's take a call, and we're going to get back into the to some of the mechanisms because they're important if you want to get it right. But we have Joey from Atlanta. Joe, you have a 1031 exchange question. Welcome to the Real Estate Hour.
Thank you very much. Yeah, my question was, couldn't you put the 1031, the money, into a trust fund and then be able to pull that out and still not have to pay the taxes on that?
Joe, that's a great question. And if you put the proceeds from the sale into a trust fund over which you are the trustee, that's just like putting it in your own bank account. No, you can't do that.
Now, what if somebody else is the trustee?
Well, I guess you could have your college roommate be the trustee, at which point your college roommate is the qualified intermediary. However, the real downside—
Would a college roommate qualify as a qualified intermediary?
A college roommate would not be an unqualified person or a disqualified person. However, the problem there is that the college roommate doesn't know the rules. And there's nobody to ask questions when you have a complicated transaction going on. And that's candidly how I earn my money.
So the trust fund, I guess, Joey, cannot be something that you have any control. Can you be a beneficiary?
No.
So you can't even be a beneficiary?
No, he can't.
What about your kids?
Nope.
Nobody
so
related.
It's your parents, your siblings, your spouse, your kids are disqualified. And yourself is disqualified. So those people cannot have control over the funds, period.
What if they have no control and they're just beneficiaries? So
well, again,
the bank is the trustee, say,
well,
and
oh,
it's the trust for your kids.
Yeah, I suppose if the bank is the trustee and the transaction is otherwise set up properly, you can't simply say, here, bank, hold this fund, this money in trust for me until I buy my new transaction. The statute's clear. There must be an exchange agreement. And most banks aren't set up to do that.
Right. Joey, does that address your question, or what's your specific situation? What are you trying to achieve?
Yeah, no, I had just, once I sold commercial real estate for a little bit, and I had, somebody call me one time and told me that they had a company that, if you're running out of time, on finding a property for your 1031 exchange, that there was some sort of system that they had that would put it into a trust fund.
Yes. Now I understand. You're going in a slightly different direction, Joe. I answered a different question. What you're asking about is a strategy that I've heard of frequently, well, not frequently, I've heard of periodically, called a deferred sales trust, or words to that effect. And there are folks around the country who are selling that as a solution to a 1031 exchange that may fail. The problem—
Meaning by running out of time.
Meaning by running out of time, correct. The problem with that strategy is that the IRS has not blessed it, and no large, reputable law firm has given an opinion that the strategy would work.
Exactly.
The folks who have given opinions are, with no disrespect to them, you know, Joe Smith, who's an attorney in, you know, Ottumwa, Iowa, with no disrespect to Radar O'Reilly, but Joe is not a nationally renowned real estate
expert.
And we're
just using Joe Smith as a common name, not
correct.
Anybody specifically.
Right.
Yeah. Joe, does that address your question?
That does, absolutely.
Great. Well, thank you very much for calling. That was a terrific question and sparked another aspect of explanation that we might not have gotten to. So thanks for being with us. And callers, listeners, please feel free to call with those kind of questions or anything else at 1-844-WHARTON. That's 1-844-942-7866. Now, Joe's call just gives me the opportunity to say something that I say in every show, which is that while I'm a lawyer, commercial real estate lawyer, and David's a lawyer, but with a specialization in 1031 exchanges, we do not give out reliable legal advice. Or when I say reliable, meaning you cannot rely on what we talk about generally. No lawyer worth his or her salt would give out legal advice that you should rely on based on a radio show or phone or something without reviewing the documents, putting things in writing, being really clear so that there's no misunderstanding. So what we try to do is give you guidance, make you sort of conversant with what's going on, so you're educated and hopefully interested as well. But please, you'd always tell you to consult your own lawyer if you really want to do something and get specific, because we're leaving out a lot of nuance that we try to cover, but sometimes there's details that just don't come through on a radio show. Having said that, David, before we get back to the analysis, we have another caller, Roberta from Little Rock, Arkansas. Roberta, welcome to the Real Estate Hour, and you have a 1031 exchange question as well, I think. How can we help you?
Yes. My question is, how do you or can you do a tax-deferred exchange with a partnership if the individual partners want to take their share and do a 1031 exchange?
That's a great question.
It's
David,
a great question.
I know you have the answer.
And it's a little more complicated than we can get into in the time that we have allocated here. The problem here is that the 1031 exchange belongs to the partnership. So the partnership is going to sell the first property, and the partnership needs to buy the replacement properties. There are strategies variously referred to as drop and swap, or swap and drop, depending on how we actually structure it. In a drop and swap, the partnership would dissolve, and the various partners would then take their ownership interest in the property. And at some point in time thereafter, the 1031 exchange would commence.
Now, you have to just be real careful, and this goes to my
absolutely.
My
that's exactly
point
where
about
I was going to go, yes.
Tax
yeah.
advice, because you could have a tax termination. You could have transfer taxes, which
absolutely.
In some states are really high, by taking it out of the partnership entity.
Correct. Absolutely.
So go ahead.
There's a variety of problems with the drop and swap, especially, and it's not for someone to just go ahead and do it willy-nilly. You really do need to speak not only with your attorney, but also with tax counsel. The alternative structure, the other structure, is the swap and drop, and that would be where the partnership sells the first property. The partnership then goes out and buys the various replacement properties, one for Mr. A and one for Mrs. B and so forth. And then at some later time, again, the partnership dissolves, and there again there may or may not be additional tax or legal implications. But thereafter, when the partnership dissolves, Roberta, you get property A and I get property B and so forth.
it.
Well, now, one thing, though, a footnote to drop to that, no pun intended, Roberta, is that you cannot, one cannot exchange securities. So you have to exchange only, in effect, hard assets. So you can't exchange your partnership interest. You can't exchange stock. You can't exchange limited liability company membership interests. You can only exchange the real estate. So the partnership would have to exchange the real estate itself, not you exchanging your interest in the partnership. Have we addressed your question?
Yes, that's very good. I appreciate your help.
Oh, thank you so much for calling. We have another few callers. Please stay with us. We're going to take one more caller, I think, before our break, but stay with us. We'll have a short break. But, Jeff, I think you're next stop from New York, and you have a 1031 exchange question as well.
Right. What happens if, through no fault of your own, your transaction blows up at closing and now you're out of time?
That's a great question.
That's a fantastic question.
And you have a lot of examples of that.
So let's think back a few years. You know, we've had hurricanes, and in California they have earthquakes, and I frequently
or
snow days. Absolutely, I counsel my clients very carefully to try to ensure that we don't schedule closing for day 179,
much less 180.
Forget about 180. I'm apoplectic on day 180. I can't imagine how they must feel. But yeah, look. We sold property number one. We did the 45-day identification properly. And to your point, the transaction implodes. We can't close. That's one of the reasons I always encourage my clients to identify multiple properties. You told me up front when you submitted the identification, I'm going to acquire one of the following three. And it's very clear on the notice that you gave me. I'm going to acquire one of the following three. So now, if the property that you had intended to close on blows up, or the transaction blows up, you at least have a potential backdoor into one of those other properties.
But the bottom line is, these are absolute
deadlines. These are absolute deadlines, absolutely.
There's, I think when we had Hurricane Sandy, we have like a mass emergency. People who can show that they were affected by that, if Congress declares.
Well, the president, what happens there is if there is a presidentially declared emergency, so we're talking events like Superstorm Sandy or Hurricane Katrina or, God forbid, another 9/11 type event. And even then, you have to be an affected taxpayer, which means that either you or a party to the transaction or the property must be in the affected zone. So, you know, when Hurricane Katrina went barreling up through Louisiana and then headed north and east, the folks in California most likely were not affected taxpayers.
So I guess the lesson to take away from that, Jeff, is that don't leave it to the last minute. Have some backup plans. Now, the worst comes to worst, you're going to pay taxes that
Correct.
You might have paid anyway.
Yeah,
so
there's
this
no penalty.
Isn't like the world ending, right? There's
right.
no penalty.
And then the flip side is I have one client who will not go to closing on his sale until he knows all contingencies have been removed on his purchase property.
Yeah, but closings do blow up.
Closings do blow up,
absolutely.
I can tell
you, Jeff, your experience with real estate. But thanks for calling. That was a great question. We have a few listeners, a few callers, rather, waiting. We do have to take a very short break, so please stay with us. We'll be back, and we're going to get to Justin and Guy and any other callers. And also, in the second part of our hour, as I promised, we're going to touch on a couple of real techniques that can save things significant money, as well as do some estate planning, and also get up-to-the-minute tax reform. Insight from David and what's going to happen with 1031s, which I think will be pretty optimistic. So stay with us, and if you want to join our conversation, call us at 1-844-WHARTON. That's 1-844-942-7866. I'm your host, Bob Lane, and you're listening to Business Radio on Sirius XM 111.
You're listening to The Real Estate Hour on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School, Sirius XM 111. Here again is Bob Lane.
Welcome back, listeners, and thanks for staying with us, for those who have been with us for the last half hour or so, and welcome to any new listeners tuning in. You're listening to The Real Estate Hour on Business Radio, Sirius XM 111. I'm your host, Bob Lane. I'm an adjunct professor teaching real estate law and transactions here at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania by night. And by day, I'm a commercial real estate lawyer practicing here at Philadelphia. My guest today is David Gorenberg, one of the foremost authorities on 1031 like-kind exchanges in the United States, former head of Citibank's global 1031 program and currently senior vice president and counsel for Riverside 1031. And we're talking about like-kind exchanges. I'll repeat the caveat for any new listeners is that we'll give you lots and lots of information and guidance about 1031s, pros and cons, some ideas, but no legal advice upon which you can rely. There's a lot of complications that we're not going to get to in the radio show. So if you're going to do one of these, get competent legal advice as well as 1031 counsel. Having said that, we've had a couple of callers who have been very patient waiting through our break, and I think... Guy is our next one up. Guy from upstate New York, thanks for waiting. How can we help you?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. No worry on the wait whatsoever. I own a golf course, and I've owned it for 31 years. Can I use that as, in a 1031 is my first question.
So the short answer to your question is yes. A golf course is an absolutely appropriate asset to use for a 1031 exchange.
Unless that's your primary residence.
Yeah, unless you live at the 19th hole. But yeah, the real estate itself becomes the asset.
So the answer, now what if you lived on the golf course? What if you owned it, but you also had a cottage on the course? Would that be,
would we carve out the cottage.
And we'd have to make an allocation.
Wouldn't
have to do a subdivision.
Yeah. And theoretically, your accountant has already been doing that for real estate tax purposes anyway.
Yeah. So anyway, Guy, so does that address your question? Or
it does. I have another question. So let's say that my golf course has a fair market value of $2 million. And
okay.
I owe, let's say, $500,000. I end up with $1.5 million. What do I do with that? Those funds go to the accommodator, the intermediary, and then how much can I spend, or how much do I have to spend on the exchange property?
Well, that's a very good question, because it's going to enable David to go into what we were going to go into in any event, is what happens when you want to buy something that's more money or less money. So we're gonna explain that pretty fully, Guy. That's a great question, but we're gonna let you go because we'll talk about that a bit, and then we'll take our next caller. Thanks, great question. So David,
so there's multiple questions in here. So we're selling a golf course for $2 million. And we're going to pay the bank $500,000 to satisfy the debt. It's going to leave us $1.5 million in cash. I could certainly go buy a $1.5 million replacement property. However, the fact that I did not replace that $500,000 becomes a taxable event. So the short answer is you want to trade equal or up in total fair market value. Guy wants to buy a property equal or greater to the $2 million.
Right. So the fact that you financed some of it is just has to do with your cash flow.
Correct.
It does not have to do with your ability or your right to trade a $2 million
Correct.
Property for another $2 million. So you could add another $500,000.
Absolutely. From whatever source. Yeah, the IRS's source. Theory is, look, yesterday you owned a $2 million asset. Tomorrow you should own another $2 million asset.
Right. Now, so you can add as much money as you want
and
buy a more expensive property, even over $2 million.
Correct.
Without any tax impact at that transaction.
Correct.
Now, what if you bought a $1 million property?
Well, so if we sold the $2 million golf course and we paid the bank their $500,000 and then we kept another $500,000 to pay off student loans or whatever, now we're at a point where we're only doing our 1031 exchange on half. So here's where I'm going to strongly suggest that we talk to the accountant and say, what is our basis here? Are we sheltering enough to even make a 1031 exchange worthwhile?
So if your basis or what your cost basis, you know, from what you're going to pay your gain on, your capital gain, was, let's make it easy. Let's just say it's been depreciated, whatever, it was $100,000. So almost all of this is gain. So if you're selling half, you're going to pay capital gain on half of the $1.9 million.
Well, right? There's not a whole lot of depreciation on a golf course, right. But yes, assuming it's a depreciable asset, yes,
because right. The land doesn't depreciate, but I guess the tee boxes and the clubhouse and the
things.
So, but whatever the property is, you're going to pay, if you're only buying a property worth half. If I'm correct, David, is this right? Then you're going to pay half of the tax.
Well, you're going to pay tax on the half that you didn't reinvest.
Right.
So, whatever dollars you do not reinvest are taxable. So here's the other part of the question. People ask me the same basic question in a different format. David, I bought a property a few years ago for $250,000, and I'm selling it for $1 million. I want to take my $250,000 out and just reinvest the $750,000. And so we all look at that initial $250,000 as our seed money. That money that we're putting back in our pocket is our seed money, and the IRS does their bookkeeping differently. That $250,000 is taxable.
Well, anyway, Guy, I'm pretty sure that addressed your question. I know we let your call go, but thank you so much for calling. And again, listeners, if you're listening on Friday, April 21st, we're here live in the studio. We're happy to take your calls at 1-844-WHARTON. That's 1-844-942-7866. Next up is Justin. You've been from South Carolina. You've been very patient. Thank you for calling. How can we help you?
Hey, guys. I actually have a question in regards to 1031 exchanges and how it may apply to tax reform. Now, I think you had mentioned that that was something that you're going to get into later in the show, and I know this is all theoretical at this point, but maybe just, you know, I'll throw out a couple of questions and then, you know, just let you guys go and give me your thoughts.
Good. We're happy to address that now. Thank you.
So, you know, obviously the way the Republicans' blueprint is written, you know, it would change a lot that would have to do with depreciating assets and, you know, expensing assets purchased immediately. So maybe just give me your thoughts on how you think that might affect the 1031 exchange industry. And then do you have any anticipation of or any rumors of that actually taking place, where the way the blueprint is written out would eliminate that, or would it still remain in some form?
Okay. Well, before I turn it over to David, that's great questions, Justin. And it's really a very good spark for a topic that we're gonna talk about right now. So the first issue is how many proposals are out there. There are a lot of discussion, and going back, I'll just
as long as I can remember, there have been proposals to modify 1031.
Yeah, and Obama had a lot of proposals.
Correct.
That didn't go anywhere. But Trump ran on, you know, and his budget was discussed back in December and January, and then there's been up until just really a few weeks ago, some more thought about this. So let's discuss some of the possibilities, and then we'll tell you certainly before we end what our opinion is based on what we know on what's going to actually happen, although nobody knows, but what we predict. Go ahead, David. What's some of the foremost proposals? We'll have to go over all of them.
So some of the various proposals are, you know, flat-out elimination of Section 1031. I personally don't think that's in the cards.
And one of the things, though, and I know you've got more statistics, but there's some billions of dollars that would be saved in lost taxes, you know, at least statistically, if you didn't have 1031s. But in concept, it pales, according to most economic studies that I've read and financial studies, against the stimulus to the gross domestic product.
Exactly. You know, the folks who say, I don't want to make this a political conversation, but when we talk about the 99% versus the 1%, those kind of conversations, people view Section 1031 as a gift to the wealthy. And the truth of the matter is, the vast majority of 1031 exchanges are much smaller in value. The average 1031 exchange value, the property that we sold, is only about around $1 million. So we're not talking about people with Warren Buffett and Bill Gates money. We're talking about the average guys that you see at the bar on a Friday night or at the bowling alley. It's us. It's you. It's me. It's the folks on the phone. So that was one thought. The other thought is, well, if we eliminate Section 1031, we can generate $40 or so billion in revenue over the course of 10 years, and that's a wonderful number, except the problem is that Section 1031 elimination would remove from the gross domestic product, depending on who you're talking about, between $60 and $130 billion in cash in volume in the gross domestic product over the course of the same 10 years. So, I guess the short answer is I'm not optimistic that tax reform is going to eliminate 1031 exchange. Let's put it that way.
So I think that's totally consistent. First of all, many people say, and right up to the minute, that when we have a president who is a real estate guy and who takes advantage of this, that while he might have made certain forecasts, and he and I think Donald Trump Jr. has and Eric have made a lot of discussions, forecasts, nothing's really going to happen.
The Trump family, the Kushner family, they're all in real estate.
In real estate. But having said all that, I think that's really the conventional wisdom, is that, and we could go into more.
But let me just make one last comment before we go on to what we're going to do next. For those of the folks who are listening who are concerned about how tax reform might impact Section 1031, I'm going to ask you to go to a website. It's a nonprofit. It's not affiliated. It's 1031taxreform.com. You can go there. You can read about some of the latest proposals about 1031 exchange. And there are some links there where it says get involved. You can click on those and pretty much instantly and easily write to your local legislators to ask them to stand up and protect Section 1031.
Excellent, excellent suggestion. And thank you again so much for that question. That was terrific. I think we're going to take a couple more callers. Steve from New York, you have a question. Welcome to the Real Estate Hour. How can we help you?
Good afternoon, Bob and Bill. Thank you so much for taking my call. The reason for my call, and this is not one of those I'm hiding the truth questions, but I do have a friend, and I'm forming a business partnership with him, and he did a 1031, he performed a 1031 exchange last year, and I had the distinct feeling that he did not have the best counsel and the best third-party holder of funds.
Well, if he didn't have us, he couldn't have had the best, right?
that's my point. I was saying from a prior appearance, I said, you listen to business radio like I tell you to. You'll hear fellows like the former head of Citibank's 1031 give you advice. And he said, I don't have the time. So basically, now he's selling another asset, and he's doing another 1031, and he's a loyal guy. He might just be going back to the same group of attorneys, et cetera. And I'm worried that if I go into a business partnership with him, one audit from last year's issue, even if he does this year's according to, you know, under better advice, might create a real disruption in his financial structure. And I want to know what advice I can give him how would he get his last year's deal, like, looked over to see what the risk is of being audited, and if there's anything that can be done, you know, prior to filing, I think he filed for an extension, to mitigate the risk?
Well, Steve, actually, that's a great question, because it really does give us an opportunity to give you some practical advice. First, let me say, we were teasing before, there are plenty of good lawyers out there and plenty of good qualified intermediaries who know what they're doing can do this the right way. If you, though, have a concern and you're about to set up shop with somebody and you feel that he or she was not well represented or may have done some transactions that may come back and haunt your joint venture, your partnership at some point, what you can do is just to get your own counsel, make sure you get good, competent counsel. And as part of any new business venture, new partnership, I would advise anybody going into it to look very closely at their prospective partner's financial situation. It would not be untoward at all to say, listen, we would just like to review the last 2 years or 3 years of transactions. I'd like my attorney to go over things and just do your due diligence. You'd kick the tires if you're buying a new car and a used car, or you'd inspect the house or any kind of property. It's the same way with a prospective partner: is ask for financial statements, accounts, and even in a partnership agreement, you might have some representations and warranties that you can check out. Does that help you? Oh, okay. Well, in any event, thank you for calling. I think we had another caller who's dropped, but Teresa from Texas, welcome to the Real Estate Hour. You're listening to Sirius XM 111, and we're talking about 1031 exchanges. How can we help you?
Well, I just have a really quick question, and it's probably a simple answer, but in doing a 1031 exchange, is does the exchange property, the new thing that you're acquiring, does it have to be a single entity, a single property, or can it be two properties that together would equal the value?
Excellent question.
And in fact, Dave, we can use that to talk about some of the exchanges.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Teresa, there's the other way around, too. If you own multiple properties and you're tired of running all around six different counties every other weekend to check on your properties, you can sell multiple properties to buy one. And in your situation, and I kind of alluded to it earlier, yeah, you can sell one and buy multiple.
Now, how does that tie into the how many properties? Because we sort of got interrupted when we were talking about the 45-day identifying properties in the different indicia. If you wanted to buy 10 properties, because you have to buy what you identify, right?
Right.
So you'd have
if you
to
don't
identify
it, you can't buy it.
Right, as part of the replacement.
Correct. So now if we're going to identify four or five, well, whatever, if we're identifying more than three properties, then rule number two, remember, rule number one is identify up to three properties, no questions asked. If we're identifying four, four is more than three. Then if we're identifying four or more, then we want to constrain that list to not more than 200% of the value of what we sold. So if I sold one property for $1 million and I'm going to identify 10, then those 10 properties, the fair market value of those 10 properties cannot aggregate to more than $2 million.
And how many of those can you or must you buy?
Well, again, if I sold $1 million property, I want to make sure that I'm buying equal or greater to my million.
So you could have, of the 10
mix and match, I could buy three or seven or whatever the number is.
Right. So, Teresa, does that address your question?
Absolutely does. Thank you so much.
Great. My pleasure.
So let's say, David, that you're buying multiple properties for your one, all right? And you've identified the 10 and they equal but they don't exceed 200%, twice what the value is. And you end up buying all of them. And so for the $2 million, what's your basis now in these properties?
So the basis in the new properties is equal to the basis in the old property plus any new cash. So here, I'm going to make the math easy. If all 10 of those new properties are worth $200,000 each, then each one is 1/10 of what we sold from before. So our basis in the new one is 1/10 of whatever our basis was in the old property.
And if they're all different odd amounts,
then
it's that percentage
correct.
Is.
And that's why we make sure the accountant has a sharp pencil and fresh batteries in his calculator.
Right. So really, if you're getting into more complicated than just one for one, things like that, you know, either you've got to be good with numbers yourself and understand all these rules or have a good accountant or tax lawyer.
And I always encourage my clients to schedule conference calls with their accountant and myself so that we can make sure we get these things right.
Great. Before we still have plenty of time, but listeners, if you're welcome to, you're listening to the Real Estate Hour, we're talking to David Gorenberg, the former head of Citibank's 1031 exchange program. And I'm your host, Bob Lane, an adjunct professor teaching real estate law and transactions here at the Wharton School by night and by day, a practicing commercial real estate lawyer. Feel free to give us a call at 1-844-WHARTON. That's 1-844-942-7866. And if you're listening on April 21st, we're here live in the studio. Happy to take your calls in our remaining time. So, David, one of the things we've also been teasing people about is some estate planning ideas. So you give a great example of a gentleman who's getting on in years and wants to leave property to his grandchildren, but has some concerns. He's built a significant amount of real estate, takes a lot of management, a lot of attention, and he doesn't necessarily want his kids to be saddled with that. So how does a 1031 help him?
So the example that I give when we get together in your classes is Grandpa owns a small shopping center. and the shopping center's worth $1 million, and it's going to be inherited by four grandchildren. And the problem is that the four grandchildren, who probably love each other very much, and they love Grandpa just as much.
No chance.
Well.
What family is that?
Yeah, sorry. So one of the grandchildren is a bit of whatever, in any event. So when Grandpa dies, these four grandchildren are going to inherit the shopping center, and we will not be able to get them to agree on what to do with the shopping center. One of them is going to want to refinance the property to take out the cash and go on a world cruise. And one's going to say, no, we should refinance the property so we can take out some cash and make improvements to the property so we can drive up rents. The third one's going to say we should just sell it and take the cash and go home. And the fourth one is out backpacking around Europe someplace with no cell phone, so we won't get him to agree to anything because we can't reach him. So what Grandpa did in this particular transaction was that he sold the shopping center and he bought four identical condominiums within walking distance of a major university. So what he effectively bought was student housing, and these properties were rented out. And to my knowledge, Grandpa's still alive. But when he goes, the grandchildren, each of the four grandchildren, will each inherit their own respective condominium separate from the other three.
So they don't have to negotiate. They don't have to agree
Correct.
On when they're going to sell or
Right.
how to manage.
Joey can sell his, and Vinny can move into his, and whatever happens, happens.
Now, there's one other advantage here, and I think I've mentioned this
right
at the beginning of the hour and then again, which is 1031 exchanges are a tax deferral program. So if I have a property today that I bought for relatively little money, and it's now several years later, it's worth a lot more, were I just to sell it, I'd have to pay capital gains on that gain. If I do this trade, this swap, then I don't, because I take another property. And if I keep trading properties, if I never sell one for cash, as long as I live, I never pay that tax. And when I die, what happens?
It's when you die, for that moment in time, and we're all gathered at your funeral, my name is David Copperfield, because the capital gains tax, the depreciation recapture tax, disappears.
So you have what's called a stepped-up basis.
The heirs inherit the property at the fair market value as of the date of your death.
So if my very first property 50 years ago cost me $1,000, and now I got $1 million worth of property at the end of my life, and my heirs inherit that, I've been exchanging.
$950,000 in gain is not taxed.
It's stepped up basis. So they sell it then for the $1 million. It's
no capital gain.
Zero.
Now, there may be estate taxes or inheritance taxes, whatever, depending on what state they live in, but different issue.
That is the that's the no tax. Swap until you drop. Of course, that's not normally a voluntary way of avoiding taxes. But look, it's going to happen to all of us.
Absolutely.
Well, David, we're at the end of our show, and you have been just a terrific, terrific guest. Listeners, thank you for staying with us. Join us again next Friday at noon Eastern, please. I'm your host, Bob Lane. You've been listening to the Real Estate Hour on Sirius XM 111. And I definitely want to thank again our very generous guest, David Gordonberg, for an exciting and enlightening hour together. I also want to thank my producer, Patty Hall. Patty, thanks so much for taking our callers and getting such good ones. And Danielle Bruno, our sound engineer, who makes us sound terrific and chooses our music in between. So anyway, listeners, thanks. We look forward to having you again next week. Take care.
For more insight from Business Radio, please visit businessradio.wharton.upenn.edu.